Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 15th, 2006. Our session today is titled Risk Factors and the Epidemiology of Child Maltreatment. Our presenter is John Knudsen, session number KNJO 2006-2. Let's listen in.
Anyway, I'm going to talk about risk factors in child maltreatment. And let me just touch on this. I didn't get to this yesterday, but I wouldn't have actually done it anyway. But this is the myth of a single form of maltreatment. There are people who think that kids experience either sexual abuse or physical abuse or neglect, and various forms of neglect, or psychological abuse as an isolated set of life-related circumstances. But in fact, there's relatively little pure physical abuse, sexual abuse, or neglect. There's more pure sexual abuse than the others, but relatively little. This is a study based on 3,001 maltreated kids in a study I did with Trish Sullivan. It was published in 98. But these are the kids who were only neglected. These are the kids who were only physically abused. These are the kids who were only sexually abused. And these are the kids who were identified in archival evidence as having been emotionally or psychologically maltreated. These are all kids from the state of Nebraska, so the criteria are based on statutory criteria in that state. And these are the kids who were neglected plus something else, kids who were physically abused plus something else, kids who were sexually abused plus something else, or kids who were psychological abused. Consistent with what I was talking about yesterday, that all the states have psychological abuse in their statutes, virtually nobody has ever identified as having been psychologically abused without some other form of maltreatment. Just so you don't think that's an idiosyncratic finding, we've got another sample it was derived from all the kids who enrolled in the Omaha public schools in the academic year 94-95. We identified 4,557 kids in the school district, slightly more than 10%, who had archival evidence of maltreatment. So you think of it as a point prevalence estimate. And again, you have pure neglect, pure physical abuse, pure sexual abuse, pure psychological abuse. Sorry about those colors. This is bad color selection for this one. But again, you can see that virtually all the kids who were neglected also had something else, and similarly physical abuse. So when you think about circumstances of child maltreatment, you don't want to think in terms of predicting that a child will be physically abused or sexually abused or neglected, but rather they might experience a constellation of disadvantageous circumstances of parenting. One thing, I threw this in this afternoon, and this is because I'm always asked, is the world going to hell in a handbasket or not? Or are we getting out of the handbasket? It turns out that some sets of data would suggest that there is either no change in maltreatment or an increase since we first started looking at it in the early 1970s. But in the last roughly 6 to 7 years, NCAN's data are reports from the state to the federal government, and they're based on archival information from the states. Not all states participate, but most of them do. There's data, and interestingly, there's comparable data in Canada now. Nico Trocmé has described some data. So there's some new data that suggests there's actually a decline in sexual abuse and physical abuse since 98, and there's a bit of an argument as to whether it's artifactual, that because of public policy changes and reduced budgets, whether we're actually investigating fewer, or whether or not there's actually a systematic change. One of the things is that there's been no decline in circumstances of neglect. They've identified no change in neglect in any jurisdictions. And the other thing that I always find interesting is there's no change in the rate of fatalities. And when we talk about fatalities, I'm talking about non-accidental injurious death, i.e. somebody engaged in some sort of activity that resulted in the child dying, and actually some frankly homicidal acts. But frankly homicidal acts are so rare that they don't account for much variance in the certain. This is where an adult actually tries to kill a child, as opposed to engaging in activities that might result in a fatality, which is a non-accidental injurious death. So there are a variety of data to suggest that in some ways, the world might be getting a little bit better, but if it is, it's incremental and it's modest. Anyway, so you know the basis of what I'm talking about. I'm going to base it primarily on some data from the two of the federal national incidence studies. I should mention that those are based, they selected counties in the U.S. that would be representative of the degree of urbanization and ethnic composition of the country. So they are, the counties are selected to be representative. And then they study those counties for a finite period of time. They go in and they train large numbers of people as sentinels. And then they identify the rates of maltreatment. And then they use a variety of probabilistic models to generate annualized estimates. And in many ways, those are some of the best studies that we have. Some of what I'm going to talk about is based on my review of everything that was published from 1962 to the mid-1990s, as well as some work that we've done more recently, as well as my collaborative work with Trish Sullivan, who used to be at Boys Town National Research Hospital, now she's at Creighton. And then as well as data from two of my current research grants. One of the things, if you want to model risk factors, and I just want to throw this out at the beginning, you want to make sure that you don't have idiosyncratic subject selection biases in your data. And the ideal circumstance is that you try to identify what Brown and Finkelhor referred to as a natural collectivity. So you find a collection of people who are brought together for reasons that are natural with respect to other vectors of influence, but not the vectors of influence that you're interested in. So you might say that the people who are here at Holden Village are a natural collectivity with respect to coming to Holden, but they wouldn't be a natural collectivity with respect to certain aspects of religious pursuits or other kinds of interests. So that if you wanted to understand the distribution of, say, being a Lutheran in North America, you would want to study that at Holden Village. And similarly, if you want to study the base rates of maltreatment, you wouldn't want to study that in a circumstance where you're increasing the prevalence of maltreatment in that sample. And then the other is that I've got a general preference for population-based studies, but almost nobody can do population-based studies, so there's relatively few. So anyway, what I'm going to talk about are three broad domains of variables that I believe in 2006 we have a reasonable degree of certainty, not 100% certainty, but a reasonable degree of certainty that these are significant risk factors in increasing the probability that a child will be maltreated. Again, risk factors suggest that these circumstances put a child at risk. It does not mean that they confer with certainty that a child that has these experiences is certainly going to be. Yeah, do you have a question?
I do. Does this take into account like the population of children whose parents have a mental illness?
Yes.
Yeah,
we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Good question. I got some slides on that.
Okay, good.
And some process kinds of. So anyway, I want to look at social and economic circumstances of disadvantage, some data on parent attributes, and some data on child attributes. And one of the things, there's a paper some years ago, well, there actually are several papers, and there's a book by Pelton, in which he argued that child maltreatment is classless, and that is that it cuts across all spheres of society. And to some extent, that's true. However, when you look at any of the data from any of the communities and any of the state records and the national statistics, the link between economic disadvantage and circumstances of maltreatment are just jarring. So the question is, why is that? And some people argued that it was due to an artifact in our social services such that persons who are economically disadvantaged and happen to be maltreating would be identified as a maltreating person because they're already in contact with service agencies. And a lot of people really believe that. I don't have the actual citation, but I can find it for you real quick. But there's a very nice study, at least I like, from Maricopa County, Arizona, in which they showed that these were adolescent mothers, largely adolescent mothers, who were identified as maltreating, and it was the circumstances of maltreatment that made it possible for them to get access to social services. But these were adolescent mothers who were, in fact, disadvantaged and were not getting access to the resources for which they were eligible. And as an editorial comment here, I can't tell you how many disadvantaged mothers I have interviewed over the years and I've known. And it's widely believed in some circles that women move between states to enjoy better social services. So the people in Wisconsin will say, well, they move up from Chicago because the opportunities are better in Wisconsin. The people in Iowa say, oh, they move from Illinois to Indiana to Iowa because we have better social services. And lo and behold, the people in Illinois say that, you know, they're moving from Indiana or Kentucky or Alabama or someplace for better services. I've never talked to anybody yet that I thought was moving for any sort of rational, planful reason to get access to better services. Most of my subjects move randomly. But anyway, so I want to address this with some data in terms of the social class artifact. And there are a variety of sets of data. We can look at household income, although there's good reason not to use household income as an index, because household income can be kind of an ephemeral variable. People change rapidly in economic reversal and enjoying some benefits at times. So, but most people do studies of economic or use household income. Well, the NIST-2 study, which used both an endangerment standard and a harm standard, showed that the incidence of physical abuse in children was 4 times greater if the household if the household income was at a $15,000 break. So in other words, those greater than $15,000 had a fourth of the rate of maltreatment as those who had a household income under $15,000. Mm-hmm. Now those data they're published in 86, but the data were actually collected in 83. So we're talking that 15K was not a lot of money at that time, but just that kind of a break. So, and then, but look at this, physical neglect, and neglect is the most prevalent form of maltreatment. If you split the sample at 15K, under 15K has a prevalence rate 12 times that rate. Now when you think of public health problems, you know, that really have significant health and social consequences, the jarring data on economic disadvantage, I think, is just unmistakable. And then the NIST-3 data, which were published in 96 but actually collected in 93, so it's a decade later, they split the sample a little bit more carefully, so they got under 15K, 15 to 30, or 15 to 29, and then 30 and above. And so you notice that with respect to neglect, notice now if you're in the greater than $29,000 rate for household income in 1993, this is representative counties, 46 counties that are representative with respect to ethnicity and degree of urbanization. Those figures just, I think, are staggering. So it seems to me that it's unmistakable with the NIST studies. The same thing with respect to physical and sexual abuse with respect to the harm statistic, or the harm standard as opposed to the endangerment standard. You know, I can send you all this. You don't need to write all this down. If you send me an email, I send you all kinds of stuff. It's just, you know, if you seized with the urge to look at this stuff, I'll send you. I do that. I'm surprised you recognize me because I'm sitting down and I made the comment that I never.
Younger pace?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, and then you can break it down with respect to degree of injury. So you can have serious injuries, moderate injuries, and inferred injuries, which would be an endangerment standard. It's the same picture. Another way to look at economic disadvantage, which is the way I prefer to look at it, actually, is to look at community indices, and there are a variety, and in my research, well, actually, I'm going to talk about it tomorrow, but we do a direct assessment of the community in which the child resides. But there's a whole series of studies, and I just picked a few of these. These are mostly, a Garbarino study that was a New York study, Newburgers, that's Pittsburgh, Zurabin is Baltimore, Alberstein, I think, is a California study, if I remember. But anyway, so these are studies where they look at the community and show that if you look for broken windows, boarded up stores, houses with bars on the windows, drug paraphernalia, broken glass on the street, potholes in the street, absence of resources, no street lights, no places for the kids to play, no midnight basketball. Those indices indicate that physical abuse and neglect are associated with those communities. Here's our data from Omaha. This is based on what we did is we looked at the census tract data in which the child resided. So we didn't actually do a scan on this one. We just looked at the census tract data and said, what's the income in that community. These are sexually abused kids, physically abused kids, physically and sexually abused kids, neglected kids, physically and abused and neglected kids, sexually abused and neglected kids, and kids who are sexually abused, physically abused, and neglected. And you'll notice that the more kinds of maltreatment you experience, the economic status of the community in which you're residing is worse. And this is the median income of the city of Omaha. So when somebody says, gee, economics doesn't affect the risk for maltreatment, have them call me. Let's talk about household attributes. This is an income, but this is just like the chaos of a bad household. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that Susan Zurabin, I think I got some slides out of order. Well, it doesn't matter. I'll come back to it. But anyway, one of the things that I was talking with somebody about this yesterday, is that Susan Zurabin, these are Baltimore data, big samples, reliable data. So anyway, the number of unplanned conceptions in the household. See, now my OBGYN friends and people who are interested in contraception keep pointing out how many unplanned pregnancies there are in the U.S., in fact, that some people argue that there are more unplanned pregnancies than planned pregnancies. But anyway, unplanned conceptions increase risk for both physical abuse and neglect. Unplanned pregnancies in spite of contraceptive efforts. So this is an unplanned pregnancy where there's random unplanned pregnancies. Then there's unplanned pregnancies that occur in spite of contraceptive efforts. And that's associated with increased risk for physical abuse. And unplanned pregnancies in the absence of contraception is associated with neglect. And conceptually, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Because if you're kind of sloppy in your planning, you're kind of sloppy in your attention to the child care. So, anyway. Maternal age. This is a thing that is a particularly important public policy kind of question. Miller reanalyzed NIS-1 data, which was the original NIST study, and identified evidence that teenage mothers were more likely to be physically neglectful of their children. And then Susan Zurabin actually went back and she did her own study in Baltimore. She had a better sample, a better database. And one of the things that she established is that the teenage mother's age, maternal age, was not a good predictor. It's mediated between the number of children in the household. Now, I want you to keep that in mind in the context. I left the site.
We have a, when welfare reform was put in place, we adopted a set of policies that require adolescent mothers to return to the homes of their family of origin. Now, the problem with that is that if you've got idyllic middle class homes, pregnant mothers who are there and adolescent mothers who are there, I'm sorry, adolescent mothers, pregnant girls becoming adolescent mothers, there's no risk for maltreatment. If they come out of a household that's got a lot of kids, family of origin, and chaotic household of origin, that's when adolescent pregnancy, adolescent parenthood, dramatically increases risk for both physical abuse and neglect. So it isn't, I'm not advocating adolescent pregnancy here, but from a public policy standpoint for the children of adolescent mothers, critical thing is to provide resources for those mothers, not sending them back to a very chaotic home of origin. Family size. If you got one child, this is risk for physical neglect and with a harm standard. So one kid, 2 to 3, not a big deal, but if you go above 4, and we go back to my previous slide, you got an adolescent mother, lots of kids, chaos in the home, bad circumstance. Now, a lot of people talk about stress, but we don't really, as a psychologist, I can tell you, we don't really talk about how you really measure stress. It's often stress is in the eye of the beholder. But Trish and I did some things where we said, okay, let's look at these things that if you were living in this home, you would find it to be stressful. So if you had inadequate housing, and this refers to inadequate plumbing, inadequate space, like we measure if a household has less than 100 square feet per person. It's a fair standard. Financial problems, domestic violence is what we got here, marital problems. Throwing in a pregnant adolescent and a newborn, having a family member that is either disabled or chronically ill, having somebody who is presenting with serious psychiatric problems, a diagnostic. Alcohol and drug problems we've pulled off. Social isolation is one that's been considered for a while. And then, of course, this typically could be related to drug and alcohol, but it could be assaults and it can be burglary and for family members who are incarcerated at the time. We got teen pregnancy in there and family members with AIDS. Okay, and then we just generate a classification of how many family stress factors do they have, and these are the sexually abused kids, the physically abused kids, the neglected kids, the physically abused, sexually abused kids, the sexually abused and neglected kids, the physically abused and neglected kids, and the physically abused, sexually abused and neglected kids. So when things are going badly, in addition to all that other stuff that's going wrong, the kids are getting whacked and neglected. This is an important slide. There's absolutely no credible evidence that ethnicity predicts child maltreatment. You have a hard time believing that if you watch cop shows on TV. You'd have a hard time believing that if you paid any attention to the families that are depicted in the media as having done egregious things with their children. But there is an important association between economic disadvantage, and to the extent that families who are economically disadvantaged are more likely to be, or that minorities are more likely to be represented in ethnically disadvantaged groups, anytime you have ethnic minority status that looks like a factor in maltreatment, it's virtually certain to be a reflection of an economic disadvantage compound.
What is the amount? What years? This is the 1990s?
This is published in 86, done in 83. This is published in 96, done in 93.
Because it reminds me of the 1960s where Martin Luther King was going through trying to deal with racism and saying the problem that was happening with race. And he finally organized the Poor People's Campaign because he found out all poor people.
Yeah, there are some data that reflects discrimination. I don't have it here.
But Hampton and Newberg are studying the Pittsburgh group, and there's a whole series of study that John Eckenrode, who's at Cornell, has done in New York. And what happens is there are indices of process factors that cause people who are minorities, and men also, because they're more likely to report circumstances of maltreatment with men and minorities. They're more likely to be reported. So there's some process factors that may reflect discriminatory processes by service providers. But that's different than whether or not... And then there's another set of data. It's a little bit of a distraction. But Ken Dodge, who does a lot of really interesting work, and some of his associates, have published a couple of papers in which they have asserted that harsh, punitive physical discipline is less detrimental to black kids because it's more socially acceptable and subculturally acceptable in the community. I take great issue with that, and I think there's some significant artifact. And Ken's a good surgeon. He does good work. But there are some real problems, I think, with their data.
I'm not sure that I was understood what I was saying about Martin Luther King. For a long time, he thought the problem was blacks were being discriminated against. But he came to the position, especially after he was in jail, and he found out that the poor whites had the same problem that the blacks did, and that it's the poor, it's being poor that's the problem, not the race or the ethnicity.
Being poor is really bad, but I think it's undeniable that we live in a society characterized by racism.
Maybe I don't understand this. What you're saying is that race
does not contribute as a risk factor in maltreatment. That is to say, if you're a child whose mother happens to be black,
yes,
you're no more likely to be maltreated than a child whose mother happens to be white.
But if your mother is poor, you have a good chance
that's
of being
right.
abused.
That's exactly
so
right.
What you're saying is poor people, not
right.
blacks.
But I also have data to say that the system discriminates against minorities.
And makes them poor.
That they are overrepresented in certain samples because of discriminatory processes. And I'm not talking about that because that's not a risk factor. That's a risk factor in circumstances of how you deal with families as opposed to the circumstance that causes the event to occur. So you've got to detect, it's like you're talking about having devices that detect something. The detection system discriminates. The process that produces the phenomenon is not associated with the DNA, ethnicity.
I guess I don't understand then. If you have a population of people that are abusing children,
I do.
Okay. And you go through, and if that population is, I'm just going to pick a number because I have no idea how to deal with it, but 80% of it is black.
That would be a bad sample to study.
So the way you get this data...
because you're overrepresenting minorities, and you're going to get an association. See, that's the wrong way to do that study.
So what you do is, by the selection process, you make it so that it is race neutral.
Exactly.
And then you go and you try to see what is doing that use.
This is race neutral.
Okay.
But that's...
Now I understand how you got your data.
But
it might have been true that all the abused kids might have, 80% of them might have been black, but through this study, you're showing it's not being black that's causing it, it's being poor.
As I mentioned before, these studies are based on counties that in the aggregate represent the ethnicity and degree of urbanization of the entire United States.
Okay.
So that those samples, the aggregated samples, are representative of degree of urbanization and ethnicity. In those samples, race doesn't play a role. In this study, which is based on my research with 592 families, they're all economically disadvantaged. They're recruited in Omaha, Iowa, and Wisconsin. We overrepresent minorities because relative to the population, of Iowa because Iowa's largely white, but we have a large immigration of minorities to Iowa City from Gary Hammond, Milwaukee, Chicago, and so forth. So my sample actually, I don't have a slide on that, but anyway, the sample is reasonably diverse with respect to ethnicity. And then we're looking at process variables at a micro-social level. So we're looking at parent-child interaction, we're looking at a whole bunch of different measures. We cannot identify any variables that are associated with race and ethnicity. As a process variable influencing neglect and physical abuse and harsh discipline. So let's look at parent attributes. Well, here's one problem. We don't know much about fathers, and we know almost nothing about putative fathers, and we don't know much about cohabiting males. They're hard to recruit. I recruit them, but they're hard to recruit, and they turn over fast. Some of my subjects, sorry about that tomorrow, but we have families that in 120 days have three father transitions in the household. So we're talking about chaos. To get them in to come into the lab and participate is a trip. And then the other thing I've been real careful in this literature is some of the data that are on maltreating mothers is really data on mothers of maltreated kids. So that's a problem because they might not have been the perpetrators. They might have made really bad decisions about the guys with whom they're cohabiting. So you got to be really careful. And there's somewhat greater risk for maltreatment of all forms if the mother's in a step-parent or cohabiting relationship. Anyway, so now here's the question about psychopathology. There's no evidence that severe psychopathology is associated, and here I'm talking about psychosis, we're talking about schizophrenia. I mean, people are always saying you have to be crazy to do some of these things to kids. But the vast, vast majority of maltreatment is not associated with psychopathology, including bipolar. They haven't been able to identify bipolar as a significant risk factor in the big picture of abuse and neglect. There's suggestive evidence of antisocial personality disorders, but there's a problem here because they actually sometimes use the maltreating behavior to contribute to the diagnosis. So if you look at a DSM-IV, diagnostic manual and look at the factors that contribute to making the diagnosis. So this is a little dicey. Maternal depression is really complex. The last time I looked at the literature and I looked at everything that was published looking at maternal depression with respect to neglect and physical abuse, the data were equivocal. And it didn't matter which criteria you use to establish depression, so you could use RDC criteria or you could use continuous measures of questionnaires. We just finished a study using both continuous measures of depression and research diagnostic criteria for lifetime depression, and we were able to show that depressed mothers with a lifetime, not necessarily current depression, but a lifetime of depression, were more likely to respond with punitive discipline with their kids, affording a greater risk for physical abuse. Now here's the problem with that. It's mediated by trait anger. So trait anger accounts for angry mothers, and anger covaries with depression. And you can go back to Freud. So the comorbidity of anger problems and depression might be mediating the association between maternal depression and physical abuse. Now, the other thing, and I don't have a slide here, but there's a study that was recently done out of the Oregon Social Learning Group. It's DeGarmo, Forgetch, and Patterson in 2004. It's in Prevention Science. And they show that the mother's depression waxes and wanes as a function of the behavior problems of the kid. So we've got there's a whole industry out there that's trying to improve parenting by working on depression. And one of my collaborators who works on maternal depression and postpartum depression, Mike O'Hara, he says people have been trying to improve parenting by fixing depression for decades, and nobody's been very successful. It turns out that maybe that you can improve the depression by working on the kids and working on parenting effectiveness. So, something to think about. Domestic violence is a strong association between domestic, and here we're talking about that there's a real problem in some of this literature. You really don't want to study mothers and kids who are in shelters if you're looking for epidemiological data. The shelter is a bad place to collect data, but there's a large literature that suggests that domestic violence is an important covariant with physical abuse and neglect. Alcohol and drug abuse, the strongest evidence is on alcohol. I consume ethanol. I keep pointing out that it's a dangerous drug. So there's great evidence that physical abuse and neglect are associated with excessive alcohol consumption. The strongest evidence is in denial of critical care. So physical care and neglect. This shouldn't be too surprising. We just finished the study, and we kind of stumbled into it because one of my collaborators in Oregon has NIDA, National Institute of Drug Abuse money, and we collaborate and look at different data sets. And we've got a longitudinal study, and our indices of alcohol and substance abuse that we get in year one, which are based on direct observations in the home and as well as parental report and a variety of indices. And these are people who are enrolled in a research project, I mean, so they know we're looking at them. But the interesting thing is that the alcohol drug abuse index of year one not only predicts neglect in year one, but it predicts growth in neglect in years two and three. So my collaborator Dave DeGarmo describes alcohol in the household in disadvantaged, neglecting families as kind of throwing fuel on the fire. You know, it's an accelerant for a problem that's already there. So I thought I'd throw this one in because the reason I included Glaxo's at Holden. There's case study information, and then there's some small sample study. Remember I mentioned yesterday about religious exemptions. But there's a few high-profile cases where people engaged in significant physical abuse, and they were from conservative religious groups. So that caused a group of people to say, oh boy, the conservative religious groups are really at risk for maltreatment. Of course, the conservative religious groups took enduring umbrage. And then, the other thing is that there's religious exemptions in Indiana where kids die because people pursue their religion. And here we're talking about kids dying from appendicitis, opportunistic infection that's relatively trivial. You know, you would Cipro or oxytetracycline and take care of it. So this has caused a lot of people to raise questions about whether or not there's a risk for abuse. And then there are a number of other groups who have been running around saying, no. Engaging in spirituality and going to church and doing all these nice things, this reduces risk for abuse. So anyway, there's actually no good data on this. And the reason I want to point this out is that I served on the NIS4 working group few years ago, which is going to be the next NIST study. And when I was invited, I was among a number of researchers who focus on epidemiological measurement issues and abuse. And I recognized everybody on this committee. And we had telephonic conferences for 9 months. Every month we met by phone. And then we met in Washington for a marathon session. And I either knew personally or recognized the names of everybody on that task force, except two. I couldn't figure out who they were. And I Googled them, and they didn't have publication track records. They were not identified as research scholars. Who were those folks? Well, one was Tom DeLay's staffer.
Oh,
the other was a guy by the name of Fagan from Enterprise. So you got two exceedingly conservative people
who were inserted by the Bush administration into a scientific group for the purpose of establishing in NIST 4 that religion was a protective factor in child maltreatment. It couldn't be done. And they tried to screw up the study, and of course some of us dug in our heels and we engaged in a spirited debate. And I don't know what's happened because our job was done. And we know what happened to Tom DeLay, so I hope his staff has gone down the trail too. And Fagan was going to send me a whole bunch of stuff that he never did. So there's no evidence that religious affiliation is a risk factor, but I want to tell you there's no evidence that it's a predictive factor either. So if anybody says it is, there's no evidence. And why embrace a theory with no evidence? Okay, here's something about mothers. Unrealistic perceptions. And this has to do with developmental standards, what you expect of a child or what your demands are. And one of the things that's very interesting is they often set unrealistically high expectations with respect to social behavior and social performance and ability to handle the commerce of life, and very low standards with respect to academic performance and success. Yeah, so it's great stuff. Anyway, that's a reliable finding. Sandy Azar is still doing that work, but she's moved a bunch, so. I want to make a comment about this because this is widely believed. And this is the notion that abused kids become abusive parents. In the 70s, as reflected in a paper by Spinetta and Rigler, 1960, it was actually published in 68, but roughly throughout the 70s, it was an axiomatic position that abused kids become abusive parents. And in fact, there were people who would go to Parents Anonymous because they were so fearful that they would become abusive because they thought they had a tough childhood. Well, anyway, in the 80s, they threw the model out because the evidence, and actually one of my students contributed to the discarding of the model because she was one of the people who reviewed all the evidence and said, oh, man, this is all confounded, it's bad science. So everybody threw the baby out with the bathwater. And then what happened in the 90s, into the 21st century, we now believe that it's a risk factor for both physical abuse and neglect. And one of the things that some of my students and I have been pursuing is whether or not it's a coupled risk. That is to say, if you have a sordid mating, one person who comes out of a disadvantageous childhood happens to cohabit and marry somebody else from that circumstance, and you have a double whammy. Is that increased risk? And there's some data to suggest that there is an increased risk. That's versus the buffering hypothesis that says if you come out of a bad circumstance and you cohabit or marry somebody that comes out of a great circumstance, you know, who buffers whom? And we actually have been doing studies where we're looking at agreement between parents. And for those of you who are parents, some of this stuff is really interesting, and to see how people set similar behavioral standards and whether they don't. Those are fun exercises. When we did this with undergraduates who were dating, they would get into such disputes that we could hear them through the walls. In other words, they had to pick a disciplinary tactic for a particular child transgression, and they had to agree on it, and they couldn't agree, and these are dating couples. And this is why I tell people that in the blush of romance, you should have a prenuptial agreement. You know, prenuptial agreements are my contemporaries who remarried, you know, and their kids are worried about their inheritance. But we really need prenuptial agreements early on so people know whether they agree on these fundamental aspects of childhood. So let me talk about what about the kids. Now, and that this is like blaming the victim, but it's not blaming the victim, it's whether there are attributes of kids that put them at greater risk for maltreatment. And one of the things, here's another myth that I want to call your attention to, and this is this notion that some kids in the household are identified. And our old friend Jerry Salm, he was a pediatrician at Iowa, he used to talk about. And he has a great Scotch accent, so when he gets to talk, people listen. And um, and he would talk about a continuum. Neglect was at one end of the continuum, and physical abuse was on the other end, and that normal parenting was in the middle, and that abusive families picked out one target kid, and they really whacked on that kid, and the other kids were kind of left alone. And that's kind of, that's why I say it's like the Cinderella myth, only the Cinderella myth is if you got the evil step-parent who's doing that too. And we know step-parenting increases risk, but the question is how does the kid play a role in that? Well, anyway, there's a lot of research on discipline. And the reason there's a lot of research on discipline these days is because we're trying to understand the contribution of shared environment versus non-shared environment to extract meaningful information about genetic contributions to behavior. So people like Pullman and others who are trying to, they don't study parenting at a microsocial level, but they study parenting in a variety of ways. One of the things that has emerged from that literature is that discipline tends to be primarily a parenting household-wide attribute. It's influenced in different ways, and you might discipline kids at different ages slightly differently, but largely the standards that are applied are family-specific rather than child-specific. And then we've done, a number of people have tried to identify, actually study different kids in families. And this study that we did, we were actually looking at ADHD kids who were young adults who were enrolled in a study at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics as kids. But the neat thing about that study, they not only enrolled the kids, but they enrolled their non-ADHD sibs, and they also enrolled a comparison kid from their classroom that was non-ADHD. So we had data and sibs. So we had sibs of the ADHD kid, we had classroom peers. And what we found is that, you know, if you've got an ADHD kid in the household, you're more likely to get whacked than if you don't have an ADHD kid in the household. But that if you're the non-ADHD kid, you're no different than the ADHD kid with respect to your disciplinary experiences. So we think that discipline should be studied in a parent way rather than just the kid as a risk factor. Well, anyway, the other one that I want to call your attention to is the disability connection. And this has been around for a long time. There were people in the 80s, this is an interesting paper, this Barden paper, because they were studying mothers of kids with severe craniofacial anomalies. And they were, one of the thing that was particularly interesting, I found interesting about that study, is the mothers of the kids with the severe craniofacial anomalies described themselves as being more nurturant and more engaging, but the direct observational data suggests that they were actually less engaged and less nurturant with their children. So they described themselves very positively, but the direct observational, and one of the things I'll talk about tomorrow is that show up is using the need for direct observational assessments of these constructs. But anyway, these studies suggested that disabilities could impair attachment, and then poorly attached parents would whack their kids and neglect them. Then there's a set of data that would suggest that disabilities increase parenting stress. I hope I have this right slide. Yep. No, I don't. There are a couple of studies that have shown that actually that's a myth. The Ammerman and some other studies, if they use big, large samples, so you got to, this is a sampling risk factor kind of thing, you've got to get the right distributions, natural collectivities. There are a lot of stresses associated with families with kids with disabilities, but this is a measurement of stress kind of thing that becomes a problem. So Ammerman argues that the link between disability and maltreatment is not specifically a reflection of the stress aspects, that it's other more process-related variables in terms of the parent-child interaction. There's data that suggests that kids with chronic illness and growth problems are more likely to be abused. There's a huge literature out of the UK and North America suggesting low birth weight and prematurity. The early studies, Betty Elmer's work in Pittsburgh and the other work she did with people at Pittsburgh has some confounds in it, but
And so we raised questions with her about it, but it turns out she was probably right. She just didn't have the proper samples. There's a variety of studies with multiply handicapped kids, cerebral palsy. Jerry Solomons used to argue that physical abuse was the primary cause of cerebral palsy, non-congenital cerebral palsy, but this is the risk factor of cerebral palsy. Developmental disabilities, Dick Sopsey in the UK has considerable amount of data there. And then there's a bunch of research. Ray Starr has pursued this notion that kids who have what are called silent disabilities, because you don't know they're disabled, and this would primarily be in circumstances of language development, learning disabilities, and things like that, that the kids violate the expectations and therefore they become treated harshly or actually neglected in the context of adequate supervision for what they need. Pete Starr or Ray Starr, he uses two names and confuses people. This is the stress factor. I do have the Ammerman and Potts study of in other words, he's arguing there wasn't a unique stressor in the big picture of stressors that impinge on disadvantaged families. The disability per se just isn't unique. I'm watching the time because I'm supposed to stop on time. Communication impaired discipline. We've been pursuing this primarily in the context of hearing impaired and communicatively compromised kids. This is a direct observational study with parents of deaf kids. I'm going to skip these. Anyway, one of the problems that early studies had was that they didn't have adequate control groups. All these case studies, I never use case studies for sources of evidence because you can't generalize from a single subject. Right? I just summarily dismiss them. They're good for generating hypotheses so somebody can go to a real study, but you don't want to develop models of epidemiology and risk factors for case studies. Some of the studies did a terrible job of defining maltreatment. There are a lot of studies with terrible sampling biases. This study, which was done by Westat, and they are the people who do the NIST studies. This is a Beltway contract research outfit out of Washington. They're good. They've got some really good statisticians. They got some people who are pretty good modelers. But the problem is they asked social workers whether or not they thought the kids were disabled. Whoops. Bad idea. So anyway, we did a study. Trish and I did a study. It was published in 98. We took all the kids at the Boys Town National Research Hospital that were seen there between 82 and 92. This is, that was 39,352 kids. And then we merged those with the central registry data of the state of Nebraska. So this would be DHS. These are the kids who... This is Foster Care Review Board, so these are kids in out-of-home placement. And these are police agency data which would reflect extrafamilial maltreatment. Most states don't require police agencies to report to DHS, so that's why you have to actually merge. That gave us 6,833 kids who had archival evidence of maltreatment. We took a random sample of 3,001. I don't know... Everybody asking, why did you get one? And I think there was a glitch in the system. And then we had 880 control kids. And here's our conclusion, that disabilities greatly increase risk for physical abuse and neglect, but no significant increase for risk of sexual abuse in the absence of other maltreatment. Remember, because you've got covariation there. So pure sexual abuse is not necessarily increased with. And that the communication behavior disorders, those are two classifications, and BD would include any, maybe AD, that would be conduct disorder kids, ADHD kids. Well, anyway, so then we redid the study, and we took all the kids who enrolled in the Omaha Public Schools in 94, 95, and then we had those same DHS Foster Care Review Board law enforcement records. So... of those 40,000 kids in the Omaha Public Schools, you can see how many of them provided evidence of maltreatment. But there's some overlap, because some of those kids actually showed up in the same... So we actually had 4,557, I think. I throw this slide in because people run around and say that parochial schools are superior to public schools, and I'm a public school advocate. Well, the problem is that the parochial schools, when they're being successful, they don't serve the same kids. You'll notice that they have very few maltreated and disabled kids. They have very few maltreated kids, and they have almost no kids that are just presenting with disabilities. Well, you carve those kids out of your distribution and see what happens to your mean reading and math scores. These are the percentage of children with specific disabilities with evidence of maltreatment. So these are kids that have visual impairments, hearing impairments, speech and language. These would be developmentally disabled kids, multiply handicapped kids, behavior disordered kids, learning disabled kids, health. That would be like childhood diabetes, things like that. Trish wanted us to pull autistics out for a different analysis. And these are kids who have an orthopedic impairment. And these are the kids who don't have any disabilities at all. Now notice, now this is a population-based study. This is all the kids in the Omaha public schools. We're not talking about, picking and choosing. We got them all. And then we reclassify them. I got to do this really fast. So if you don't have any disability, this is your risk for neglect, your risk for physical abuse and sexual abuse. If you have a psychiatric, which would be a behavior disorders, conduct disorder, threw the autistic kids back in there, which actually lowers the risk. Well, anyway, the point I want to make here is that for all these disabilities, they're at greater risk for neglect than the kids without a disability, and they're at greater risk for physical abuse than the kids without a disability, except for the multiply handicapped kids. And they're approximately equal or less rate, except for the DD kids, for sexual abuse. So, now here's, I'll throw this in real quick, I gotta bail out. But anyway, neglect, physical abuse are primarily intrafamilial. There's a little bit of extended family on neglect because they were charged with the responsibility of child care. Some physical abuse for extended family. You notice how few extrafamilial abusive events there are. For sexual abuse, and this is one of the things to keep in mind, you have immediate family, extended family, and then extrafamilial sexual abuse. But before you start thinking about it being stranger danger, see, I'm always saying in my classes, get the kids out on the street where they're safe. Well, this is intrafamilial. This is the relational characteristics of sexually abused perpetrators. This just repeats the previous slide, right? Intrafamilial, extrafamilial, or extended family, non-familial. Notice this, 94.6% of the perpetrators were known to the victim. 86% of the perpetrators were male. Of the intrafamilial, 71% were parents and 29% were siblings. I gotta say something about.
I'm gonna skip.
I gotta quit.
Right? 10 words.
10 words. This is my senior reading. One of the things is a disability a risk for abuse or a consequence? And in fact, it's both. But the consequence, and I just did, what we did is we had a cohort of kids who were identified with a disability before the maltreatment occurred. And then we look at them after. And then we have another set where we only look at them because we didn't get them. But here's the critical thing. Behavior disorders are consequences and risk factors. Speech and language, communication, learning disabilities are risk factors for maltreatment. And then you miss a lot of school. The average, and you never get into the system because you miss school. You miss school, the average kid in Omaha, this is the control, it's a weird slide. They miss 9 days of school a year, about 2 weeks. All the maltreated kids miss an extra week. And there's their reading, and there's their math. So if you say, well, this isn't a public health problem, it surely is an education problem.
Sorry.